Hello everyone, welcome to this edition of Cronscast, the official podcast of SFF Chronicles, the world's largest science fiction and fantasy community. I'm Dan Jones.
And I'm Christopher Bean. It's December, and as any genre fan will tell you, that means one thing, horror. Okay, perhaps not horror, unless you count office parties, but the tradition of the Christmas ghost story, particularly in the UK. Over the past 50 years, it's become a common custom, with the BBC regularly airing standalone episodes called A Ghost Story for Christmas. Over the years, A Ghost Story for Christmas has engaged the talents of Lauren Gordon Clark and Mark Gatiss in bringing the stories of M.R. James and others to life on our screens, to the point that it has replaced Raymond Briggs's The Snowman as the nation's favourite TV show, according to a recent parliamentary review. With that said, who's our guest today, Dan?
Our guest today is the author Alison Littlewood, who has added to the tradition of Christmas ghost stories with her novel Mistletoe. Ali's first book, A Cold Season, was selected for the Richard and Judy Book Club and was described as perfect reading for a dark winter's night. Her other titles include The Hidden People, The Crow Garden, and The Unquiet House. She wrote The Cottingley Cuckoo as A.J. Elwood, along with the forthcoming The Other Lives of Miss Emily White. Alison's short stories have been picked for a number of years' best anthologies and published in her collections Quieter Paths and Five Feathered Tales, and has won her the Shirley Jackson Award for short fiction. Ali lives with her partner Fergus in a house of creaking doors and crooked walls in deepest, darkest Yorkshire, England. She has a penchant for books on folklore and weird history, as do we all. Earl Grey tea, as do we all. Fountain pens, as do we all, and semicolons. So welcome, Alison.
Hello. Thanks for having me along.
No, thanks for joining us. How are you?
Yeah, great, thank you. It's quite a dark wintry night here, so all very appropriate.
It is very dark, it's very wet, it's very windy and blustery in all corners of the UK, so this is perfect weather for huddling down in front of the fire, close to Christmas, and talking about ghouls and ghosts. Normally, at this point, we kick off with the question, why did we pick a Christmas ghost story? Or why did you pick a Christmas ghost story to talk about? That's kind of obvious from the biography. You've contributed to that pantheon of literature. So I'm going to ask, what drew you to the Christmas ghost story tradition in the first place?
Well, I'd written another novel called The Hidden People. That was the first one that I completely set in the Victorian period. And then I wrote The Crow Garden that, again, kind of went even deeper in terms of research, because that one touched on spiritualism and seance rooms and hypnotism and phrenology and all sorts of things that were going on in the period. And obviously, I was very conscious of that tradition of telling ghost stories at Christmas that became certainly increasingly popular in Victorian times, with Charles Dickens doing things like popularising ghost stories for Christmas in magazines like Household Words and All the Year Round. And I thought, wouldn't it be lovely to kind of hop on and join in that tradition and do a novel-length ghost story that it's not set completely in Victorian times. It's actually contemporary, with glimpses of ghosts that are back in the Victorian era. And the two time zones begin to intertwine, almost like mistletoe twisting around a branch. The past starts to reach out and affect what's happening now. So, yeah, that was my inspiration for it, really.
Well, the mistletoe, I mean, it's there in the title of the book, but it's the idea of mistletoe as a parasite is the theme that runs through all of Mistletoe, the novel. And that idea that the past is somehow parasitic and it's leaching on the present is a very ghostly vibe. Where did you draw on the idea of the mistletoe being the central theme?
I didn't want Christmas just to be a backdrop to the story. If I was going to do a Christmas ghost story, I wanted the season to be integral to it and to play its own role. So I started to look at not only the history of some of the traditions that we follow now at Christmas, but also the folklore around various Christmassy things. And one of those I started to look at was mistletoe. And there's such a wealth of folklore around it, from old kind of housemaids' rites where they'd mark a mistletoe leaf with the initials of a man that they fancied and wear it next to their hearts to as an old charm to kind of bring him closer. There's obviously the kissing under the mistletoe, but also I found a wonderful vein of lore about the way that mistletoe is associated with the dead. So in ancient Greece, Aeneas plucked a golden bough of mistletoe to be able to access the land of the dead. But also, like in France, they call it spectre's wand, and they think that if you hold mistletoe, then it enables you not only to see the dead, as my character begins to do in Mistletoe, but also to make them speak. That was hovering at the back of the whole plot of the novel as it evolved, really. So it comes from folkloric things about the plant itself.
Well, Bean is our resident folklore shipper, I suppose you would say. And he is all over this sort of the idea of the land being tied to the dead, the land being tied to the past, and the ghosts being wended into the architecture, wended into the natural landscape of the world that we build and that we inhabit and then we inherit that's all around us. It seemed, do you think that there's an idea that because winter is, well, it's the dead land, isn't it? Winter is a spectral wasteland, especially in the Northern Hemisphere. So if we're taking the UK as the backdrop to this story and France and Greece, so when we get cold, bleak winters, the land is dead. And traditionally, I think it was around the midwinter, around the winter solstice time, that the veil, that liminal space between the land of the living and the land of the dead was at its thinnest, so that humans and mortals were closest to the spirit world than at any other point of the year. So before Halloween metastasized into what it is today, it was actually this time of year.
Yeah, indeed. And this is one of the reasons why people have traditionally brought evergreens into the house at this time of year, because all the other plant life did just look dead, but the evergreens had this special power of retaining life in a dead season. So there's that connection with eternal life, and you know, it got tied to spirituality. The roots of Christmas, the reason they chose the 25th of December was, it harks back to several Roman festivals, one of them being Saturnalia, which was just before, but also Sol Invictus, which was the festival of the unconquered sun. So they believed that the sun was gradually dying at this time of year because the days are getting shorter. And then at the solstice, which in the Roman calendar was the 25th, it was resurrected and began to come back to life. And there were also various cultures had sacrifices, midwinter sacrifices, to kind of to bring the earth back to life and make the land fertile again and move back towards springtime. So yeah, definitely that association with death has always been there, because people can see that in the land and the shorter days and so on.
You mentioned this in Mistletoe. It's quite astute of the Christians to impose their nativity story over in a pre-existing mythology or a pre-existing festival at the very least, which is far more ancient than the nativity story itself. So it's piggybacking on these ancient rites. But what was sitting underneath the nativity story, as well as like the Old Testament stuff, and there's actually a far more ancient pagan history and mythology sitting under that, and that is still reinforced to this day.
Yeah, it was always easier, I think, to subsume the different religions as opposed to killing them dead. I think probably one of the reasons why Christmas is so popular now is I think it's probably quite a natural thing to want to enjoy ourselves kind of against the dark. And you know, there's this feasting at a time when the land isn't productive, and, you know, giving gifts to people and just enjoying ourselves a little bit. And that actually harks back to kind of what those early festivals were like. So Saturnalia was a time of feasting and giving gifts to people. I think it would have been a very difficult thing to quash that, really. Christianity came along and subsumed these old festivals. Even centuries after, there was some sort of decree given by the church to remind people that they weren't worshipping the sun, and it was actually Jesus, you know, so these things kind of lingered on in ways that weren't intended at all.
Were you drawing on the more modern, but that Victorian tradition of telling ghost stories when you were writing Mistletoe? So did you look at people like M.R. James? Did you look at Jerome K. Jerome, Henry James, that sort of thing?
I looked at Dickens slightly later ones. I've read a lot of Victorian short stories. It's funny though, because although they became very popular at Christmas, a lot of the stories actually aren't very Christmas-centric. Yeah. Some of them aren't even set at Christmas. It's just very the tradition of telling them, really. I mean, even something like The Turn of the Screw is set in a framework, which it's easy to forget, actually. It starts off with a bunch of guys sitting around at Christmas Eve saying, let's hear a spooky tale. And then they tell this story of The Turn of the Screw, which has nothing to do with Christmas. And it's easy to forget that little kind of preface to it. But yeah, I was very conscious of the tradition. And A Christmas Carol is the obvious one, of course, because it's actually about Christmas. And was massively popular. It sold out almost as soon as it was published, and there were just lots and lots of editions that came out even in the following year. And it was made into a stage play, and it was performed by Dickens in various venues. And
A Christmas Carol, I don't think we should dwell on A Christmas Carol too much. On this podcast, we always do spoilers for whatever we're talking about, but I don't know, do you think we should give away the ending of A Christmas Carol?
I think everybody knows it by now, don't they?
You reckon? Okay. But I don't think we should dwell on it too much, because it's so all-pervasive. But you can't talk about Christmas ghost stories and not at least acknowledge it. But it's because A Christmas Carol is imposed on an ethical framework. And it, as you said, it does embody the spirit of the season in a way that, well, I don't suppose any other ghost story does, but it is still, in its own way, it is still a horror story, at least at the beginning. It's quite unsettling. It's quite disturbing when Marley makes his first appearance. And in some of the flashbacks, when Marley and Scrooge make the takeover of the mortgage company. It's that's horrific in a different way, in the human element, the way that both of them treated their fellow man with utter contempt. And that, again, that past is parasitic and it leeches on present day Scrooge. So there is that theme of the past, or the ghost of Christmas past is emblematic of that, of the past leeching on the present and sucking the life out of it. Now, I like that idea in Mistletoe, but that's a common theme of ghost stories per se, wouldn't you say, Chris?
Yeah, and I think what's really nice about Mistletoe is that it wrong-foots the reader, because, well, I don't know. It depends on your own cultural capital, because for me, whenever I think of Mistletoe, it's either been Asterix or Christmas, come here and have a tricky, you know, smooch, a non-consensual kiss, basically. But no, I mean, it's always been associated with positive things. Even though I've known about it being parasitic and seen the trees, especially in France, they have these trees where they look just like a nests of these globes of mistletoe in them. But actually, for the mistletoe to be almost like a cat's paw for evil or something wicked, and then also we start to drift into elements of folk horror as well. So it's so much more complete than a simple, oh, it's a ghost story and it's set at Christmas, because we've got the baggage that Leah brings with her to the cottage, what she's had in to the farmhouse, what she's had in, what's happened to her and the effect that's had on her, and then this numbness about her, which, you know, there's this parasiticism of mental health in terms of, you know, loss and grief and the kind of things that I was thinking about comparing it to the loss that I've been through. It really is, it's not as simplistic as a horror story for Christmas or a horror story or a ghost story written for Christmas or at Christmas, because there's so much other horror in it.
I thought the folk horror element was probably the most explicit. Look, Leah, she's described as a comer-inner. That's the phrase, isn't it? The Johnny come lately, the outsider. And that is weird fiction, isn't it? That's folk horror. That is the outsider entering into a sort of ersatz closed off community, which has its own rhythms and its own fluxes and refluxes, and she's unaccustomed to them. I mean, there is a twist that, and this isn't a spoiler, and we probably won't go into spoilers for Mistletoe in case people in case people pick it up. Everything else, you know, the M.R. James stuff, I think that's fair game. The twist early on is that she is the descendant of the original owners of the farmhouse in Yorkshire that she buys after being bereaved of her husband and son. There is that sense that she is a Cymmerinna, but she's also not. Her blood and her past is already there, and it's leeching on her in a couple of different ways. It's leeching on her through the bones of the building itself, but also through her own grief. And you know, grief is it's a common hook on which to hang a ghost story.
It is, but she is, as you say, going back to an old family home, and I think that's often a role of ghosts as well, in that they are memory and they are unfinished business. And in this case, it becomes very personal to the protagonist. So there's a definite connection that she had with that land to begin with.
I was going to say, coming back to the thing about folk horror, I wouldn't put this as a folk horror tale. I would say there's elements, just because you're talking about something that's happened. I think folk horror is about forgotten skills and the old ways coming back. And there is that element of that here, but there's also that element of moving on from those, which is what, of course, happens at the end. Oh, we're not doing spoilers, are we?
Well, that's kind of par for the course, that, you know, at the end of the ghost story, you have to move on in some form or another. But, you know, we won't go into the details of how that happens.
Yeah, for sure. And it's not Leah's purpose to kind of bury herself in the past. She's actually trying to move on and to return to living life, really. But in the meantime, she's in this this place that's almost shrouded in snow, and she get it. The isolation of it is quite unexpected. So it's a little hiatus in the process, really, of moving on. And the snow and the setting and the winter is a part of that, I think. It reflects what's going on inside her.
Yeah, the isolation as well, the numbness and these. We had a really interesting conversation. The last podcast we did was with Emily Inkpen on the Left Hand of Darkness.
Left Hand of Darkness, yes, of course. Yeah, with the icy wilderness.
Yeah, and we were talking about the absence of light if you don't have dark, and vice versa, and the yin and the yang and stuff. And there's an interesting sort of flip on that, I was thinking, in this text, in terms of the mistletoe being the implacable middle ground of non-black and non-white, and that it's got the berry and the leaf, the male and female principle in the text, but also the fact that it goes in between and it's this dependent on the tree, and that it goes in between it. I don't know. I just picked that up as a really nice comparison to the Left Hand of Darkness, you know, and the stuff that happens on the ice there, which is so polarized of good and bad, hot and cold, black and white, male and female. It's so strongly drawn because of the subject matter of that book. Whereas for this, mistletoe is this middle ground where you might be used to hearing it in terms of a positive way, but there is a side to it. Well, I don't want to say that sinister side of mistletoe, because I sound like a odd Discovery Channel program. But the fact that it's a very unplaceable cipher.
The mistletoe is a symbol of death. And yet we bring the symbol of death into our house. Is it because it occupies that sort of liminal space, that represents that liminal space that you're talking about? That sort of, it's not one thing, it's not the other. It's a sort of a crack in the veil, crack in the mirror.
Well, I never really picked that up until I read this book. I never really thought of mistletoe like that until I read this book. But those thoughts came to me as this liminal middle ground. But it wasn't until reading what Leah goes through and the way that Ali's written it, it makes you automatically think about mistletoe in a different way without sounding trite.
Well, it's weird though, because we all know that everybody says, oh, do you know mistletoe's actually poisonous? Yeah, we know. So we do have that idea that mistletoe is quite pretty, it's decorative, it's associated with the season, but it's also a poisonous parasite. So we kind of already know that, but yeah, it feels like this, the idea is developed a lot more in this, and it's given time to grow, if excuse the pun, and it becomes the central motif. It entwines itself around the whole environment that she's found herself in, because it also destroys the orchard as well, doesn't it? So it's not just in the house, it's destroying outside of the house, so her whole local environment is being infected by the mistletoe.
It does. I mean, and there are these associations of mistletoe and death, but it's also associated with life. So, you know, being an evergreen in winter, it has that connection with vitality and life and fertility as well. And where it's connected with the dead, I mean, for example, in Norse myth, there's the myth about the death of the god Balder, who interestingly was the god of the summer sun, and he was killed by a weapon made of mistletoe. But then his mother's love brought him back to life, and her tears were said to become the berries on the mistletoe, and she made it into a symbol of love, which is one of the explanations for why people kiss under it. So it has that dual thing again. And you mentioned it being toxic, which it is, but over the centuries, it's been used in folk medicines, you know, and people have drunk tea made out of it and things. It does have very much a dual nature going on.
So would you say, because you said you wanted to write a Christmas story where it wasn't just happened to be set at that time of year without any justification, but would that therefore make mistletoe, the plant, more important than Leah to you? I mean, what was the focus for Leah, for her story? How did that come about?
Well, do you know, I just pieced it together. My starting point was the research about mistletoe, but obviously just writing about the folklore of a plant is nothing without the character. It's got to sort of have an effect on someone and make the reader feel something. And that's where it becomes all about Leah's story and her living her life now and trying to move on from difficult times. Yeah, so one thing just led to the other, really.
That's the way.
But when I start to write, it's not kind of recounting a text about mistletoe. It's a person's story, so it becomes about their thoughts and dreams and ideas and so as soon as I started to write the book proper, yeah, the character takes over.
Yeah, it becomes more self-governing, doesn't it? A story. The more and more you write, it starts to write itself in a certain extent.
Yeah, definitely. It's that weird magic, isn't it? That you don't quite know how it all pieces together, but somehow your subconscious makes it happen. Yeah, but it's all about, for me, I've got that character in my mind and I tend to visualize what they're experiencing. Oh. So it's almost like transcribing in a way, that whenever I set down that first draft of a story. So yeah, it becomes all about the character.
And I've jumped away onto that's what I wanted to ask about Leah, but I've jumped away from the mistletoe. I can't.
Bean?
I know, sorry.
What are you doing?
I don't know, mistletoe.
Have you been at the Jameson's again?
No, I haven't. No, I haven't been at any alcohol. I've had a cup of tea, Yorkshire tea, in honour of...
of our guest.
Yeah. Yeah, no, just the whole thing about plants, holly, the ivy, and the one thing that's really enjoyable for anybody who's into the sort of mythology, folklore of plants, any kind of New Age even, and pagan, anything at Wiccan, there is a really nice elements peppered throughout the story where Leah is thinking or reading or having some kind of discourse about a plant, whether it's ivy, mistletoe, holly, and you get a little bit, like a little tab, like a wiki tab of information about it, you know, the stuff about the ivy, what's the male, what's the female, why what the berries are for, why the leaves are shaped, you know, the way they are in the mistletoe. And I really enjoyed that as well, because I mean, I'm an absolute huge nature freak. I really write a lot of nature stuff in my writing. So to read that was really, really rewarding, because I felt it wasn't like I was listening to a TED talk, you know, especially with genre fiction, like science fiction. Somebody can be banging you on the head about railguns or the mechanics of whatever. We don't get any of that in your story. We don't get any of that. Okay, and this is the mistletoe, and this is why. Do you understand now?
She's considering Christmas, of course, as well, and her memories of Christmas with her family who've died and they're gone. So she's remembering Christmas as past, really. So things like that just occur to her as and when they're relevant to her story and what she's feeling and are related to those things. So yeah, they are intertwined with the story, but they're not. Yeah, it wasn't a case of I want to shoehorn this in somewhere. You know, it was really as they occurred to me in relation to her story as I was writing.
We tried to talk about useful. Well, we tried to explore what things work in particular books, because a lot of our listenership are writers themselves as well as readers, and we try and tease out what works to try and, you know, see what's best practice and how to approach things. What I think you did really well was wear your research lightly, if that makes sense. So there's clearly a lot in there, and whether that's, I can't tell whether you'd researched that specifically for this novel or whether that's just stuff that you have banging around in your head and you knew that off pat, which is great because it can be all too obvious sometimes when somebody's as Chris said, like you know you drop a Wikipedia page on how a railgun works, for example, and it's just information overload. Whereas you drop in the idea about Saturnalia, I didn't really know much about Saturnalia. I knew about pre-Christian festivals, but I didn't really know the details. So it was quite nice and, you know, a little bit educational and informational for me to read that. But that's an example of conveying the information that's factual, but also relevant to the story in a light-handed manner.
Yeah, and some of it was researched and some of it is just stuff that's banging around my head and probably banging around all our heads after, the, you know, however many Christmases we've had. Yeah, and there are things that I put in there that are just very personal to me at Christmas. So for example, when Leah discovers her Christmas decorations in the box and each one of them carries a memory. So it's almost like she's laying out a story of her and her son's life together, and she's putting them back onto the Christmas tree and recovering those memories. That's just because that's what my Christmas tree's like. You know, I always like to pick up different things every year from different places that mean something to me, so that when they come out of the box, it's like, oh yeah, that's from a festival in Lincoln, or that's from holiday in Germany. You know, and it's like telling stories to yourself.
Because it's so heavily seasonal in a way that the summer isn't. The summer is sort of hazy and it sort of drifts over the course of 3 or 4 months, whereas Christmas is focused, it zones in on this one day of the year. Even Easter is a movable feast, literally. It changes in relation to the equinox. But Christmas zones into this one day, so everything is very, very tightly seasonal. And you do accrue these very specific memories which are embodied in these little bits of tinsel and little baubles and strange little decorations. You can lay out a chronological recollection of your life, and I like that.
Yeah, and they're individual to that character as well, but they're also things that everybody can relate to because of those rituals at Christmas that we all share. I mean, there's not many of us that are all that religious anymore, but there are certain things that, you know, we all recognize and have often experienced ourselves. So yeah, hopefully it taps into that.
And also, I think one of the things that I felt was in Leah's mind was what she should be doing, as opposed to how she felt or didn't feel, what she, you know, of any emotion or whatever. And there's a 1 year where I didn't put my Christmas tree up, and I didn't put it up not in a sulk, but because I was in such a dark place. The thought of even decorating it with these memories of happiness and this performative element of Christmas. Whereas, you know, Dan, you're mentioning summer, and we don't, as human beings, we don't have to do anything in summer except just burn ourselves.
Just lounge about and
lounge around. Yeah. At Christmas, you're expected to make this sort of supplication. You're expected to make something if you're, you know, actually even not if you're Christian, to be honest. Now it's more of a cultural thing than a religious thing.
Well, I mean, it's still there, isn't it? You mentioned Saturnalia. And Saturnalia was,
but I'm talking about what Christmas has become, because I don't think anybody will look into think, oh yes, this is the ancient festival of Saturnalia or whatever. What I mean,
no,
is,
but my point was going to be that the Saturnalia festival was almost an act of defiance, like shining a light in the encroaching darkness, in the knowledge that the light is going to shine again, sure, because the sun will start to grow. You said Sol Invictus, the sun is unconquered. The sun will start to rise. The days will get longer. So it's a defiance against the dark. And if you don't do it, people always say of people who don't get into the spirit, it's a bit of an awful phrase, but get into the spirit of Christmas. And, you know, that's an interesting turn of phrase, spirit of Christmas, but maybe we'll park that for now. That people say, oh, they get very grumpy, they're not getting into the spirit of Christmas. And it's almost like giving into the darkness, you know, going towards the darkness, the darkest point of the year, without holding that light up. Even if that light is a tawdry neon sign, you know, as you're drinking a triple Baileys.
Yeah, Leah, at the start of the story, she is running away from all of that because she's in a difficult place and she doesn't want anything to do with Christmas. Actually, but it's strange events in the house and seeing these visions of the past that start to draw back into it. And she, you know, that there are new connections being made within neighbours and things. So she's almost like pulled into it unwillingly and rediscovers it.
Because there's so much you could take from that as a central sort of thesis. Are there any things you had to cut? Because it's quite, it clips along the book. It's a short, quick read rather. Did you you have to cut stuff out? Did you rather not have to? I know this is a bit of like a hidden extras on the DVD thing, but I felt that maybe there could have been a real deep dive in places into certain sort of folkloric or cultural observations. Is that something you wrestled with?
I mean, there's always the question of where somebody's getting their information from. If they're, you know, an isolated character, she's not kind of an encyclopedia, so it all had to relate to something and come from somewhere, or she had to, you know, find it out from neighbours or look it up or, you know, something. So there were limits to how much information I wanted.
Because she learns a lot of stuff from the visitations of the dead as well.
She does, yeah. They're kind of conveying information about old sort of rituals of mistletoe through their actions and through story. But yeah, I didn't really cut a massive amount from it. I think there were certainly some things that I felt I'd overloaded with information and I cut it back.
You have to be careful. Because
I did want information to be carried by story and not to info dump you or anything.
It's weird, isn't it? Because some things, if you're into them, you'll let an author get away with murder with info dumps if it's something that interests you. But then other times you can read something, you can be completely unforgiving. So you never know what's the right thing to do as an author with stuff like that, because you can't guess your audience.
Yeah, I think if it keeps carrying the plot forward, you know, if it's important to character development or if it's conveyed in action, then I think it's pretty safe. But yeah.
The other thing that we say, especially Bean is a big advocate of this approach. The other thing is if it's just beautiful writing as well. Yeah. Sometimes I don't think you can sustain an entire book on that.
No.
But sometimes you can just let the writing be. If it's that good, you can just let it be.
Yeah.
It doesn't have to. It can just build mood.
Yeah, but mood and atmosphere is so important in the ghost story as well.
Yes.
I can't remember who it was that said that details are everything in a ghost story. So I think you're building a specific sense of place. And, you know, I tried to make the descriptions in the book really immediate. So I wrote it one winter, and whenever it snowed that winter, I chucked on a coat and ran outside, you know, and I was like standing in the snow and making snowmen out there on my own, feeling like an idiot, but just experiencing it all and touching it and feeling the cold and just writing down all my first impressions of that straight away, so that when I came to write particular scenes, I could draw on those notes and try to make the descriptions really immediate.
I wanted to talk about M.R. James, and you gave me a bit of a ham-fisted segue into that by saying writing about detail and writing about atmosphere, and the master of the atmospheric ghost story is M.R. James. But shall we do that in the second half of the podcast?
Yeah, let's do that in the second half. There was one thing I wanted to ask, actually. Are you thinking of moving on?
Moving on in what sense? Like, into the liminal, into the afterlife? Or?
Well, we can all hope. I mean, onto away from the story and more onto writing and Christmas ghost stories and stuff, just because there was something I wanted to ask about mistletoe.
Oh, go for it, yeah.
I want, you know, we're talking about geography, nature and place, and with geography, I wondered where your, you know, if your inspiration for the setting was just because of that's where you live, or if there was some place you'd been specifically that you had in mind, or, you know, there were elements to it that you know, were, you could imagine was a deep farm, a farm in the deep south, although it's winter, whereas mostly there were elements where it was like, okay, this is what the moors would be like for Heathcliff if it was snowing all the time.
I that's exactly the thought that I had. Yeah, Wuthering Heights, absolutely.
Yeah, it's not a specific village. It's somewhere I've made up, but it's an amalgam of lots of places where I've been. So when I was growing up, I spent time in friends' farmhouses. And when we were house hunting a few years ago, actually, we went and visited quite a remote, very broken down, shabby farmhouse that, you know, certain aspects of that have found their way into the book. But actually, I looked on Rightmove. I don't know if this is standard practice for writers or if it's cheating a little bit, but I just looked at farmhouses for sale in Yorkshire and found reference photos of the very place that, you know, that fitted perfectly in my mind. So the exterior of the farm is based on some random person's farm on Rightmove.
That's brilliant.
But I have those reference photographs in front of me, but the interior is kind of based on, it's an amalgam of a few places.
I love that. And I'm gonna shoehorn in a reference to Shirley Jackson, because won the Shirley Jackson Award. But didn't she base The Haunting of Hill House on a floor plan that had been drawn out by people who had conducted a seance?
No, I don't know that one.
I'm not sure. We don't have to do anything with that, but I thought I'd slot it in there. Let's take a break. We'll talk about M.R. James a little bit later, because we have to talk about Ghost Story for Christmas. I'm sure it'll be a bit of a revelation for our non-UK listeners, but it's worth talking about. Yeah, it's been great talking about mistletoe, and it must be good to contribute to that niche sort of Christmas ghost story literature in your own way. I suppose when you're writing a book like that, you're sort of hoping that you're going to become the Noddy Holder, aren't you, of Christmas ghost story literature, and you can just survive on the Christmas royalties for the rest of your life.
Well, that would be nice. I enjoyed doing it anyway, put it that way. But yeah, I don't know about that part. I'm not sure it's quite the same way for writers.
Well, I heard that he could receive £800,000 a year off of that song. Even if he just sat on his ass the whole year and didn't do anything, he'd still rake in £800,000.
Well, so there you go.
That's something to aspire to. Okay, thanks, Ali. We'll see you later on in the show.
Hello, is that SSF Chronicles? Look, I'm ringing to complain about the standard of broadcasting coming from Mars. Now, I know technically I'm not in the same jurisdiction and I don't pay a license fee, but I still have the urge to complain. And to be honest, it's an absolute disgrace. There's nudity, there's no end of cursing on it, there's pop music, there's, like I was saying, the cursing, like, you often hear the word flump and fiddlesticks. You can't move for fiddlesticks on Martian radio, in fact. Look, hold on, I'll give you an example.
Hi, hello listeners, welcome to Mars Radio 14, the third best radio station in the Martian Space Force broadcasting spectrum. My name is Private Half Milk Carton, and today I'm going to be looking at a phenomenon known as ghosts. And to do this, we have sent Lieutenant Bungalow to planet Earth. Bungalow, can you hear me?
Yeah, okay, Half Milk Carton, I'm at the house now. Wait, hold on, there's someone here. Hello, madam. Yeah, my name is Lieutenant Chubbalon Bungalow of the Martian Space Force. I'm on a fact-finding mission to Earth to see what we can find about ghosts. Do you mind me asking you a few questions?
Who did you say you were with?
The Martian Space Force, ma'am. Best space force in the solar system.
Solar system? Never heard of that.
Outer space, ma'am.
Outer space? Is that the new laser tag place in Balasadir?
No, ma'am, the cosmos. Like, I'm from the stars, you know.
Well, now, fair play to you. What brings you here?
A rocket ship, ma'am. I'm looking for ghosts.
But Temple House Manor isn't haunted.
I'm sorry, ma'am, but we've had reports of strange damp patches on the floor and a French dresser that moves slightly to the left. You know, all by itself. So this place is definitely haunted.
Well, I don't know about that. Sounds to me like someone was having you on.
Don't be foolish, ma'am. Why would an interplanetary detective travel 83 million kilometers to Mars to tell us stuff that didn't happen, huh?
I don't know, but they're wrong.
Well, with respect, ma'am, how can you be sure?
Because we've never had a French dresser. I've been the chair lady here for 367 years.
Hello and welcome to the Judge's Corner with me, Damaris Brown. Back in my first talk in January, I discussed copyright and what it means for us as writers. For this final talk of the year, I thought I'd return to the topic, this time dealing with the more complicated issues of plagiarism and copyright infringement, at least as they appear under the law of England and Wales. There is no single standard definition of plagiarism, but it most often relates to passing off someone else's work as one's own. And in academia and journalism, at least in the West, it's seen as a serious breach of ethics. In artistic circles, of course, taking inspiration from or paying homage to other work is commonplace. As Picasso might or might not have said, good artist copy, great artist steal. In the UK, and I believe it's the same in the US and other common law countries, there is no specific tort of plagiarism, so we have to rely on the law of copyright. But while the two concepts overlap, they're not identical. As I explained in January, while copyright gives us rights over our original work, for example, the right to say who may reproduce it and on what terms, ideas aren't protected, only the expression of those ideas. However, as has been said in the Court of Appeal, no clear principle is or could be laid down in order to tell whether what is sought to be protected is on the ideas side of the dividing line or on the expression side. So it's impossible to say exactly where we can draw a distinction between the legitimate use of someone else's ideas as expressed in their work and the unlawful copying of the expression of those ideas. In the words of one Lord Justice, it is easier to establish infringement of the copyright in a literary work if the copying is exactly word for word, verbatim or slavish copying, or if there are only slight changes in the wording, perhaps in some optimistic attempt to disguise plagiarism. Copying of that kind, without consent, is on the expression side of the dividing line, and the original will be protected, subject to any defence such as fair dealing or fair use. Conversely, a simple broad concept, a school for magical children, for example, would be on the ideas side of the line without legal protection. That's because copyright is granted in recognition of the investment of effort, time, and skill involved by the author, and that tends to lie in the detail with which the basic idea is presented. But between these two extremes, verbatim copying on the one hand and vague abstract ideas on the other, is a grey area involving issues such as themes, characters, incidents, scenes, structure, and choice of material. This is where legal arguments get complicated and some lawyers get rich. So if there is no set principle as to which side of the line plagiarism of this kind will fall, what can we learn from decided cases? Well, first and foremost, according to the Court of Appeal again, if material is found in a later work, which is also in an earlier copyright work, and it is shown that the author of the later work had access to the early work, an inference of copying is raised. However, similarities resulting from coincidence or from the use of the same or similar sources arouse suspicion, but they are not actionable as infringements of copyright. So whether there was access to the earlier work, or if similarities can be explained in other ways, are matters that must be considered. What this can involve was shown in a judgment handed down only in late October, in a case brought by Anna Pasternak, the author of Lara, the Untold Love Story That Inspired Dr. Zhivago, which for shortness sake I'll simply call Lara from now on. Her book, which was published in 2016, is a factual historical account of the relationship between her great-uncle, Boris Pasternak, and his lover and muse, Olga Ivinskaya. The defendant in the case, Lara Prescott, also wrote about the couple in one of two narrative threads in her novel The Secrets We Kept, published in 2019, and it was Anna Pasternak's contention that Prescott had copied a substantial part of the selection, structure, and arrangement of facts and incidents from Lara. Note that substantial, by the way, as that's a necessary part of a claim for copyright infringement in England and Wales. Prescott readily accepted that she'd read Lara soon after it was published. But by then, not only had she undertaken a good deal of research herself, but she'd also completed the first draft of her novel. She admitted using Lara in subsequent drafts, and she'd mentioned it in the acknowledgements in her novel, but only as a secondary source material, checking facts against other sources and looking for details not found elsewhere, because in her view, it contained nothing major that was new, large parts of it having been taken from other books she was already using. Pasternak didn't return the compliment of reading Prescott's work, which the judge called extraordinary, and one might think it raises the question as to how she thought her book was plagiarised. Apparently, a review was prepared on her behalf, and though it wasn't admitted in evidence, it presumably formed the basis of a court document which listed in detail the specific facts and incidents, or events, in Lara, which Pasternak claimed were copied, together with supporting allegations of minor copying, which in themselves were not enough to have copyright protection, but proved that Prescott was indeed taking material from Lara. But the document which Pasternak relied upon towards the end of the trial was greatly changed from the one originally filed with the court. Taking one chapter, the judge noted that the final list of allegedly copied events was a considerably pruned version, with the first 12 events noted in the original having been removed in their entirety, because it was apparent that the defendant had written her own treatment of these events before acquiring a copy of Lara, and therefore they couldn't possibly have been copied from Pasternak's work. This, the judge said, was an apt warning in a case where authors are using common sources and making reference to actual historical events against assuming copying simply because of a similarity or apparent similarity of events and their selection. A second point the judge made about that chapter was that the list of events set down in the document represented only a small number of all the events Pasternak had covered there. She'd written about a good many things in the chapter, but was claiming only a few had been copied by Prescott. The judge noted that, in making the comparison between the relevant chapters of the books, it is important to make sure that the comparison is a full and fair one, rather than isolating certain events. In this respect, he'd already referred to an earlier court decision where a judge had warned of the danger of being misled by what may be called similarity by excision, where the court is concentrating only on matters that are similar, losing sight of any differences, and thereby creating an illusion of copying. He explained this with an analogy about two people dropping similar small quantities of sand on the floor. The original pattern of sand would be very different, of course, but if one removes all the grains of sand which are not in equivalent positions, all you are left with are those which are in equivalent positions. If you look at those remaining grains, it is possible to say that similar patterns of distribution exist. It is even possible to say that these similarities are surprising. But the similarities and the surprise they elicit are an artifact created by the very process of ignoring all the other grains. In addition to considering the document setting out the alleged copying, together with all the other court papers in various incarnations, over some 6 days in court, including 3.5 days of cross-examination, and with evidence from 8 witnesses, the judge was taken through the minutiae of Prescott's writing history, the various drafts of her novel, and the structure of both works. The length of the case is shown in his judgment, which deals with each and every allegation of copying in detail and runs to over 82,000 words, longer than the first draft of Prescott's novel. His judgment must have made for grim reading for Pasternak. She had one small victory over a translated passage, which had been copied without sufficient acknowledgement. But the judge decided against her in respect of each and every point relating to the selection, structure, and arrangement of the facts and incidents in Lara. He found that Prescott had used other books as her primary sources and had copied nothing of substance from Pasternak. Some details claimed as supporting allegations which were taken from Lara, a reference in one draft of Boris Pasternak's loopy scrawl, for instance, were entirely consistent with Prescott using the book as a secondary source, as she claimed, and did not, on their own account, amount to substantial copying and therefore did not enjoy copyright protection. The judge went on to say that even without going into specific detail, taking the material as a whole, he would have reached the same conclusion, because the two books were fundamentally different. A non-fictional historical work on the one hand, and on the other a work of fiction, described as a spy thriller, loosely based on real events, woven into a story devised by Prescott and adapted to suit that story. Furthermore, the works were written in very different styles, with different content and arrangement, and the fact they followed the same basic chronology was unsurprising when they dealt with the same basic historical events, using the same principal source materials. One significant legal point in contention between the parties was whether Pasternak was actually entitled to copyright in respect of the event she claimed had been copied. She had herself made extensive use of work from other books, and the judge found that this included direct copying of text from her source materials. As a result, the defence argued that the material allegedly copied from Lara was either not original or was of only a low level of originality and therefore not protected. In this matter, Pasternak was successful, with the judge confirming she not only had copyright in the book as a whole, but also in all the areas alleged to have been copied, since copyright can subsist in the original skill and labour or intellectual creativity used in selecting and arranging material taken from other sources. One case which the defence relied upon in this argument arose from the book The Holy Blood and the Holy Grail, two of the authors of which brought a copyright claim against Random House, the UK publishers of The Da Vinci Code. The authors alleged that Dan Brown had copied a substantial part of their work in the course of writing some six chapters in his novel. He patently hadn't copied their exact text, save for a few instances which were held to be so minor as to be irrelevant, but, they claimed, he had taken their book's central theme, which they said was their original work. To quote the judge in the Pasternak case, the claim failed, essentially on the basis that the so-called central theme, so far as it could be found at all in the Holy Blood and the Holy Grail, existed as no more than a selection of features from the book, collated for forensic purposes, which did not qualify for copyright protection as a substantial part of the work. The claimants lost the Holy Blood case at first instance and at appeal, but the Court of Appeal laid down guidance as to what was protected. The literary copyright exists in the Holy Blood, by reason of the skill and labour expended by the claimants in the original composition and production of it, and the original manner or form of expression of the results of their research. Original expression includes not only the language in which the book is composed, but also the original selection, arrangement, and compilation of the raw research material. It does not, however, extend to protecting information, facts, ideas, theories, and themes with exclusive property rights, so as to enable the claimants to monopolise historical research or knowledge and prevent the legitimate use of historical and biographical material, theories propounded, general arguments deployed, general hypotheses suggested, whether they are sound or not, or general themes written about. So, regardless of the fact that, as the court accepted, it takes time, effort, and skill to conduct historical research, to collect materials for a book, to decide what facts are established by the evidence, and to formulate arguments, theories, hypotheses, propositions, and conclusions, there is nonetheless no copyright infringement if someone replicates or uses that research regarding historical facts, virtual history, events, incidents, or makes use of those arguments, theories, propositions, and conclusions. But what if someone copies not from a factual source, as in the Pasternak case, or what may be only semi-factual, as with the Holy Blood, but from someone else's original fiction? To find out, you'll have to wait for my next talk on copyright infringement.
Hello, welcome back to Mars Radio 14, the third best radio station on the Martian Space Force broadcasting spectrum. Now listen to this. There have been reports of strange activity taking place on the planet Earth. Lieutenant Bungalow has just travelled there to find out what is going on. Can you hear us, Bungalow?
Yeah, okay, Half Milk Car. Now I'll try to see what's going on. Oh, wait, there's someone here now. Excuse me, sir. My name is the Lieutenant Bungalow of the Martian Space Force. Do you mind if I ask you a few questions?
You're from what?
The Martian Space Force, sir. It's the greatest space force in the entire solar system.
Is that a podcast?
No, well, yeah, sort of. You know, we're trying to find out more about Earth. And in particular, why you have so many candles and psychedelic lights and ornamentation strung around your dwellings and public transportation arteries. It's kind of weird.
You mean the festive decorations?
I mean, if that's what you call them, yeah.
They're for Christmas. It's a Christian tradition. It's just something people do to celebrate the birth of Christ. Where did you say you were from?
Mars, sir. The greatest planet in the universe. With the greatest space force in the universe to which I... But did you mean Jesus Christ?
Yes.
I mean, he came to Earth?
Yeah, hold on. Why did you say it like... Earth?
Well, because, you know, this place is, Well, how do I put it? Diplomatically, I mean, it's kind of a dump, you know what I'm saying? I'm sorry. I didn't think he'd want to visit here.
Well, he did. How do you know him?
Oh, Martians know Jesus Christ. I mean, he swings by every month for the EVM races. That fella loves the anti-grav circuit. And boy, does he know how to party. I mean, I gotta have the day booked off for when he arrives. His visits are legendary, man. There was this one time we put on a Nangle Ball game between the Martian Space Force and the Navy firm, and Jesus got so fired up on Space Grog that he accidentally teleported the whole planet to Andromeda. Oh, man, he still talks about it. Great times. And what did you end up doing when he called?
Is that the time? Sorry, I just remembered I have to do something somewhere else. Goodbye.
It's time to journey down to the writing challenges for this month. It seems that all the Kronzcast team are going through a little purple patch at the moment on the challenges. So in October, yours truly was the winner, and I set the challenge for November with the genre of historical speculative and the theme of questions, and it was won by our very own Brian Sexton. So, if you think you can do better, then all you have to do is go to sffchronicles.com and join up for free. If you are a writer and you're listening to these the challenges that we have on the show and you're thinking, you know what, I think I could do as well as that, maybe a bit better, then you got nothing to lose by trying. In fact, it's a great way of improving your writing chops. I found it really useful over the years. Christopher would say the same thing, and so would everybody else that's been involved in the challenges. It's also great for getting ideas. My novel Manowar came out of a 75-word challenge. So if you are a writer and you hear these challenges and you think, I want to get involved, then toddle on down to sffchronicles.com and sign up for free. Anyway, here is the November winning entry, read by our very own Brian Sexton, and it's called, Ah Sure, Nobody'll Ever Know the Difference.
Houston, you're go for landing. Over.
Roger, understand. Go for landing.
Copy.
We're go. Hang tight. We're go. Altitude, 1600. Altitude, 1400. Looking very good. 1201.
Roger. 1201.
47 degrees.
Roger.
Houston, Olympus Mons base here. The Eagle has landed.
Roger. Olympus, we copy. Wait, what?
The Eagle has landed.
Not that bit. Did you say Olympus Mons?
Yes.
Oh, God damn it. You numpties just landed on the wrong celestial body.
I was thinking it looked a bit red. Oh, sorry, Houston. What now?
You three head home. We'll see if we can cobble together some studio footage or something.
Welcome back to part two of the Kronzcast. This month we are with Alison Littlewood. We've been talking about her novel Mistletoe, but now we're going to move more towards the Jamesian things with A Ghost Story for Christmas. More talk about that, but we'll also drift into influences and, you know, stuff that Ali has to say about horror. So what I want to say is that I love A Ghost Story for Christmas.
Really?
Yes, particularly the Lawrence Gordon.
Do tell.
Wow. Ones. Lawrence Gordon Clark did a lot of the ones in the 70s, which are phenomenal. You know, when you think about 70s genre stuff, and I don't know, you could come up with some of the aliens in Doctor Who being ropey, you know, poorly rendered, poorly executed special effects. Something about this Ghost Story for Christmas, the way it's filmed, the actors. Also, you know, when you watch something from the 70s nowadays, you automatically feel some sense of time having passed. And there is some chilling stuff to these old things. And they're all available on YouTube, as far as I'm aware. Well, that's where I see
most of them are. Yeah, yeah.
And I think part of that is because you don't read an M.R. James story or The Signal Man by Dickens or whatever, where it's rah, 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 and this happened, and then Godzilla comes and that happens. It's just this slow build up and this quiet sense of dread that gets worse and worse, or that you know the environment or the environs, rather, that something's going to happen. But when it actually happens on the what's that podcast called? The M.R. James podcast. Well, it's quite hard to remember that name, isn't it? The M.R. James podcast, they use the term the Jamesian wallop. And I think that's such a delightful term for what happens in an M.R. James story. When you get the punch at the end, you have the sheets from O'Whistle, you have the spiders in the ash tree, you have I can't remember his name, and I'm going to be shot now.
We should translate for people who are not familiar with the M.R. James canon. Okay. So O'Whistle, and I'll come to you, my lad.
Well, I'll translate for them. Is get your bloody books out and find out who M.R. James is, and then go onto YouTube and watch them, just like any other person has to do.
The Ghost Story for Christmas started with O'Whistle, and I'll come to you, my lad.
I don't know. Is that the omnibus one?
The omnibus. So there was an old BBC program called Omnibus, which is an arts program. And you have to be really of a certain vintage to, I mean, I only remember the very tail end of Omnibus.
Yeah,
but it was an arts program that went on for donkey's years. And it did an adaptation of Oh Whistle and I'll Come to You, My Lad, which is about an academic, as is often the way with M.R. James protagonists, who has a sort of skeptical outlook towards ghosts and ghouly things like that. And, well, it all goes a bit wrong for him. But there's no need to go into spoilers, because it would ruin the atmosphere. But the 1968 adaptation, it's in black and white. It's made on clearly a shoestring.
45 minutes long.
But it's 45 minutes long. It's on YouTube. But it is one of the most masterful pieces of ghost storytelling.
It really is.
Committed to TV or film that I think you could find. It's genuinely creepy.
I mean,
it's very funny. It's very funny. And that's mainly because, what's the name of the actor?
Michael Horden.
That's it. It's genuinely funny, the way he sort of potters about and labels things in his sort of halfway eccentric, genial, academic, professorial manner. But when the wallop comes at the end, it's very creepy.
Yeah,
it's genuinely horrible moment in the story, I think, which it's the key moment, and they just had to get it right. But they do genuinely make it creepy, don't they?
It really does. Do you know, it's got this almost cinema verite feel to it, the way it's as if you're watching something that's been recorded live on someone's camera, even though it's 1968 and black and white, or it's this even earlier than that, the omnibus version itself. But you get this sense of being witness to something incredibly you don't
intimate.
What I'm saying is you can't even place it. It's not like, okay, here's a man wearing a sheet going woo, because it isn't. We never know what the spirit is. We don't know if it's a ghost. We don't know if there's a link with Templars and the precepts. It's never explained. It is just there, and it's so unsettling.
Yeah, it's very pared down, isn't it? There's nothing particularly explained in it, or not very much at all. And some of it's simplified, really. I mean, the preceptor isn't really in it. He just goes and takes the whistle from an old grave that's broken open on the cliffside instead. And it's just very visual, isn't it?
Yeah.
And it doesn't require a lot of dialogue. Although it only occurred to me recently why they've made him almost this bumbly fellow. Because in the written story, M.R. James has him as a young man who's very neat and precise in his speech. He specifically says that. And this character on film is actually very bumbly, and he mutters to himself, and he's almost irritating. You know, if he was in real life, you kind of want to slap him a little bit.
Oh, definitely.
But I think because it is made very visual, and he's on his own a lot of the time. He's in these long scenes where he's just looking at things and gaining impressions, and it's working by suggestion. But if he didn't mutter to himself, you'd have no dialogue at all. and it would just be the sound of the sea in silence, and perhaps people would drift away from that. And it does enable him to kind of explain things a little bit. So when he's examining the whistle that he's found, he kind of goes, bumble, 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 oh, inscription. And then he kind of tells you what the inscription is.
Yeah.
And it seems natural. It doesn't seem like it's suddenly
right.
information that's dropped in, because that's his character.
And it's not painted a very good picture of anyone that age, really, because when he arrives at the hotel and he's being shown around the hotel by the owner, the hotel owner doesn't use words. He goes, oh, it's over there.
Yeah. He does it back to him, doesn't
yeah,
he?
Yeah, and
it naturalizes it, but it's slightly.
Exactly.
I mean, if that was reality, yeah.
Yeah, and when there's a and like Dan says, it's very funny, but also it's that tightrope of cringe and the horror of watching somebody being inept, you know, not just the horror of the story itself, and this sitting, you know, and I suspect a lot of that down is they must have allowed Michael Horden some freedom and ad libs, but when he's sitting down in the dining room,
not much dialogue. I imagine a lot of it was ad lib.
Yeah,
because there was
because he's saying he talks to his plate. I use him in one of my books, and he says, didn't ask for tomatoes, don't want tomatoes, didn't ask for tomatoes, and flicks them off. And then another bit, he's...
I love it when the dog goes past him and he says, there's a sort of dog.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's really funny.
And he tells, like you're going on about when he's cleaning up the whistle, oh, a scription of some kind and 50 tricks a Boy Scout can do. I mean, it's just so painful, but it is compelling, and you know...
Yeah, he's this character. As an academic,
yeah, and he's
so he's an emblem of competence.
Well, he's
and
learned.
I learned from a book. That sort
exactly.
of competence. Yeah. Whereas I love that theme. When I was writing my manuscript for The Green Man, that's the principal theme that I was trying to nail.
What was?
Which James does masterfully in just a short story. The fact that there are, I guess if you boil it down, it's the more things in heaven and earth than your philosophy is Horatio, which is a line that the Colonel actually uses in
A
Whistle
and
a Country
Mile. Dialogue about, you know, what he means. He needs the question qualified before he can even answer the question. He needs the question verified as a verified thesis before he'll even entertain it.
Well, and it's the danger of limiting oneself to only proposition-based thinking rather than...
Excuse me, that's what happens when I drink non-Harrods tea.
Yeah, he does say some... I mean, it was one of the Jamesian things, isn't it? In that he felt that protagonists should be very level-headed and ordinary, so that when they're faced with something off-kilter and supernatural, I guess it's all the more... rattling for them and therefore for the reader as well.
Yeah, I mean,
I mean, we look at it now and, you know, it seems like they're period settings, but actually he wanted contemporary settings and for that to be characterful, but in a way quite ordinary as well, so that by contrast, the supernatural would be all the more effective when that final stab of horror comes.
The protagonists of an M.R. James story are typically these academics or these antiquarians who are about to have the entire paradigm shift of this is what my life is, this is what I can expect, just from sometimes a very simple paranormal experience. And I think that it's quite, on one hand, it's quite hard to sympathize with them. Well, no, it might be quite hard to empathize with them, but it's quite to sympathize, because even though Parkins in O Whistle is this young academic, I will always see him as Michael Horden because of that omnibus thing. Also feel slightly protective of him. Like, this is my clunky grandfather who I really need to look after. This is, he doesn't really understand how to use an iPhone, so I'm going to help him. Do you know what I mean? He's that kind of character. And the way he bites his thumb at the end, where he's just saying, no. I mean, it's everything about that version on YouTube, the omnibus version is...
The idea of the protagonist, I like the idea of the protagonist being this fastidious, not just of O Whistle, but across the Jamesian canon. In Stalls of Barchester, the protagonist relating the story is... a library, he's a, what's the word? He's a categorizer. That is not the right word. What is
he's cataloguing.
They're just an antiquarian.
He's an antiquarian, but he's also...
cataloguing a library.
A cataloguer, that's the word.
Yeah. Which is something that M.R. James did himself at some point, isn't it?
It's a good job you're here, Ali.
A lot of the stuff he did was what we're responsible for, you know, a lot of data that's being used these days by academics, M.R. James transcribed.
I like the idea of the the character being a cataloger or catalogist, so his existence is defined by putting things into their rightful places, which is kind of quite a Victorian thing to do, actually, in the Victorian scientific mindset, putting everything in its proper place, categorizing everything, making sure we understand the world in proposition-based thinking. And then something happens and it blows all of that out of the water, and you're left with, when you've only got proposition and catalog-based thinking, you've nowhere left to go. All of the pillars that hold up your worldview are just knocked out from under you, and you're left in this, more like Parkins at the end of O Whistle, you're left in this sort of chaos of nothingness, and you don't know what to do with that. I wonder if the idea of a ghost story for Christmas is, as well as being in touch with the ancient pagan rites and that liminal space between the living and the land of the dead, it's also a bit of an antidote to a time of year that can become super abundant in with respect to its saccharine nature.
Was it like, would you have imagined it like that though when M.R. James was writing these? They might.
Well, the Victorians, they said that the Victorians invented the modern concept.
Yeah, but I don't think they invented
as we understand it.
You know, like they didn't take it the direction, say, of of Coke with a Santa Claus train, you know, on the 13th of November every year or whatever, you know, just heralding Christmas in so early. I think there's still a sort of magic about it in those areas. But I see what you mean. Like there's this, it's also very British to have this, oh, it's a lovely time of year, so let's write a horrible story. You know, that's very British.
Yeah, and some of those ghost stories are pretty horrible. The Ash Tree.
One of my favourite M.I. James stories. It's absolutely horrifying.
And that's on YouTube too.
Yeah, and that's really good, quite really good. There is the end part of the Ash Tree, that is, will give you the ick, the YouTube version.
It's very strange, isn't it? The end of the Ash Tree.
I was like, oh, this isn't going to be, I love this story, but it's not going to be very good because I know in the 70s, how the BBC going to, you know, produce that. But
special effects, yeah, how they do the special effects, but they manage
it. They do it so well. Not so well if we can stick with O Whistle. Ali, have you seen the, shall I say deplorable, or should I just say, what do you think of the Michael Hurt, the John Hurt 2010 version?
I have watched it. I'm afraid I just can't really remember.
I think that's probably
much how it is. That terrible?
No, it's probably for the really best. As far as I'm concerned, I mean,
I've worked on a lot of stuff since then. I think that's the problem. There's only so much your memory can take before stuff starts falling out the other side. I mean, the last one that I watched was The Stalls of Barchester Cathedral, and I mean, that came out the year I was born, 71. And I was astonished at how professional it all looked. Is that awful to say as well? It was just beautifully done, beautifully put together, a great representation of the book. And actually, if I dare say, some of the moments in it are actually creepier than when you read the story, I think, just because of the timing of it. For example, when the Archdeacon Haynes in it is waiting for a manservant to come and collect a letter from his room, and he hears this ghostly whisper at the door saying, "May I come in?" And he says, "Certainly you may." You know, in the TV version, the door opens and there's just that little space of time where you wait and nothing appears, and then he opens the door and there's nothing there, and it's just so beautifully timed. That's a genuinely creepy moment that actually you could gloss over quite easily in the story and not really pick up on much about it.
There's something about the actors as well, I think, because yes, it's James's source material, but having 70s actors, especially before people who might have cut their teeth before the massive bloom of television, are these theatre actors, these incredibly dour or declamatory Shakespearean sort of performances from some of them. And I've really, you know, I think that's another reason is it's remained about the character rather than, oh, well, this entire thing is up to the reveal at the end. All we're working for is the reveal of the sheet at the end of O Whistle. Well, really, it's actually, these are people, these are characters. And by having a well-chosen cast and a good script, you're going to care about them. So when that one little thing happens at the end, there is a much bigger gravity to the entire story.
It's weird. I found that the old Ghost Story for Christmas adaptations, a lot of them, apart from maybe the quality of the quality of the actual film itself, I don't think they're that dated.
No, because
they're period pieces, I think, to begin with. And so once you do a period piece It doesn't really matter when it's actually filmed. I don't think it's dated because they have so little reliance on production effects or visual. If there's no visual effects at all, I mean, I take your point about the spiders in the ash tree, which is very disturbing. And I'm not sure how they would have done that on their shoestring budget. But I don't think it's as dated as you think. A BBC special from the 1970s is going to be wobbly cardboard sets and Daleks, but it's not. It's all you shoot on location a crumbling old stately home, use some great character actors, and you've got the whole production off the bat, and they stand up remarkably well.
And also that's the good thing with ghost stories, isn't it? It's always, well, actually not with M.R. James, because he does a lot of demon stuff, but with ghost stories you don't have to have that effect. You can create an actor as a dead person, like in the famous one that everybody loves, Warning to the Curious.
Yeah,
the ghost of the guardian in that is not particularly scary in any way, but it's a presence, and it's also the way it's shot, this long distance and I'm sure that's influenced from the O Whistle version with Michael Horden, where he's on the beach and there's the tiny, tiny apparition in the background, and then it gets closer, and there's sometimes he's on the beach and he's a tiny apparition. And these expansive beaches that and East, is it, trying to think of the place where it's based, what was the name?
Oh, Suffolk.
Yeah, what's he gives it a name, and I can only think of,
is it Alfley or something?
Yeah,
like that?
It's something like that.
I can't remember.
Anyway, I'm sure so many people who've gone to produce TV versions of M.I. James stories have that image of that singular body, that person on a beach or in a wide natural space, because it happens so often in those things. And in and then you've got the other ones like Karen Albrecht's Scrapbook, where you do have the demon. So obviously, and they've never done it, Karen Albrecht's Scrapbook, so far as I'm aware, and that's one of my favorites. I'd love them to do, but that would be a bit more of a challenge for it to maintain its integrity over time, needing special effects and not having them, because you are seeing a demon there.
Ali, you've got a bit of news, actually. We mentioned it in the introduction to this episode, that you've got a book coming out soon. Is it the anthology that you've got coming out soon, or a novel? I know you've got something coming out under your pseudonym.
Yeah, I have a couple of things coming out, actually. I've got a little mini collection of Victorian short stories coming out with a publisher called Blackshuck Books. And that's under my name, Alison Littlewood. It's called The Flowering. And it's just Victorian strange tales, some are ghostly, some are mysterious in other ways, but all of them set in that era. And then the novel is The Other Lives of Miss Emily White, and that's coming out under the name AJ Elwood in April next year. And that's a tale, it's set in a Victorian school, and there's a new teacher comes along, and very soon strange rumours start circling that she's being seen in two places at the same time. And one of the girls has a book that was around at the time that mentioned a teacher from a slightly earlier time called Emily Siggy, and this is an actual book. And she was rumoured to have a doppelganger. So it becomes a case of whether this book is being used as a blueprint by the girls to play tricks on the teacher, or whether there's genuinely something uncanny about her. And there's one of the schoolgirls called Ivy, who's become a little bit attached to this teacher and quite obsessed with her, and she's kind of stuck in the middle of the two. So it's her story of how she resolves what's going on.
Fantastic. Is that going to be published by Joe Fletcher Books?
It's not. It's coming out with Titan. In April next year.
Fantastic. Can we talk about The Flowering a little bit, as we're on the topic of ghostly tales? I'm particularly interested in this, and I think Bean probably will be as well. We've written quite a bit of short fiction over the years, of varying lengths, from flash fiction. Well, on Crons we have the 75 word challenges. So that's a real micro fiction,
right?
All the way up to sort of novella length. And one thing we've taken as received wisdom is that finding a market for short stories is nigh on impossible. It's very, very difficult. And just so we put a definition on short story, I'm going to use the definition of between 5,000 and 10,000 words in length per story. Is that fair?
Yeah, I mean, there's room for shorter still, I think.
Yeah, one and a half.
There are always exceptions, aren't there? Ones who take ones that are a little bit longer as well. But yeah, that
okay, so a little bit of leeway there. But we've heard from different sources. We've both had short fiction published in different forms, but we've heard that the market for it is very, very difficult. So I'm really interested in how you worked with Black Shark Press, because I know Black Shark Press, Chris, you're aware of them as well, aren't you? That they publish ghost stories and horror. Is it particularly British, isn't it, Black Shark Press?
They publish a series of anthologies called Great British Horror, yeah.
Great British Horror, yeah. Right. So I'm keen to understand the relationship between you and the guys at Black Shark Press, how they view the market for short stories. I know that it's a specific genre, but how they view the market for short stories generally, and how they make it work, and how you pitched it. So could you tell us a little bit about how the flowering came to be?
Okay. I mean, it may not be a very typical story, really. I mean, certainly they've been around for a few years, and I think they just know the market really well. So they tend to approach people and ask them to write for them. A couple of years back, I was asked to do a story for one of the Great British Horror anthologies, so I did that. There was another anthology that they were doing with the guest editor, and the guest editor approached me to write for that one. And the Shadows collection came about because of those prior contacts. I've got to know the editor there, and we were chatting at Chillicon earlier this year. And it was quite funny because Steve came up to me and said, "How about doing a Shadows collection?" And I'd gone along to the same event with a little pitch with a couple of different ideas of themes for a Shadows collection. So I was like, hang on a second, there you go. Do you fancy doing one of these?
Well, that's brilliant.
And we settled on the Victorian one. So it just came together through networking, that one really. But how he goes about sourcing things generally, you know, he'd been doing it for a few years before I did a story for them. So he just knows the market inside out. So I guess it's, you know, reading other magazines and things. I'd probably have to ask him, really. But he's certainly around at conventions and things like that, getting to know people and who the writers are and so on.
So there is still a market for short fiction.
There is, and that one for me, certainly in my case, it was very much on personal contact. But you know that there are magazines out there that publish the submission guidelines and you know, tell people how they can submit and what format they like and so on. I think certainly my impression is that it has got harder just in terms of numbers. I mean, I used to look on a website called Ralan.com, Ralan.com. And it lists different markets that are looking for submissions. And I seem to think that there used to be a lot more around. So from that point of view, it probably has got more difficult. But the website's still there and still listing different markets. So, you know, that's one place that people can go and look if they're starting out and looking for where to submit.
Well, one of our listeners once remarked that he listened to several of our episodes, and we've interviewed authors, agents, people who've worked in publishing, and they came away from it feeling mightily depressed about the whole enterprise of writing, because there's a dwindling number of opportunities and an ever expanding pool of increasingly talented writers out there who are competing against one another for those opportunities. So I always think that to temper the cold mathematics of the writing game, you've got to boil it down to why you're doing it, which is not normally for success, but it's normally because you have to do it. It's normally because it's the vocational side of writing.
Yeah, I mean, we do it for love, don't we? Let's face it, really. I think that's how we all start out. And you know, I just wrote for my own benefit in the early years. And yeah, I started trying to get short stories into different publications. And I was in the sort of free to read online stuff and for the love markets and things like that. And you do set yourself targets to reach and you want to get out there. But if you didn't love the actual writing, I'm not sure any of us would really be doing this, because that's what it comes down to, isn't it? It's, most of this is you in a room with a laptop and you're fighting your own personal battles with the words and the wanting to put a better plot together than you did last time. And, you know, that I guess that's it's the stories and the words that drive us, really.
I think a lot of people have a problem with the idea of
effort
writing. Not even that. I was getting at the idea of producing something, a manuscript, a story, and then it never sees the light of day, apart from maybe the odd beta reader or the odd proofreader. And certainly I've written stuff that will never see the light of day, which is probably a mercy on the world and upon me as well. But I'm happy with that. And I don't regret having written them because it leads to other things which are better.
That's just about expectations.
And possibly more productive. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, everything's a learning experience, isn't it? I always used to find that even when I wrote a short story that either got rejected everywhere or I just thought wasn't worth sending anywhere, I'd still learn something from it and go away and want to do something better next time. And I think that's the best way to go into writing, really. Just try and be a sponge and learn all that you can and just keep improving. So you're kind of battling yourself. But obviously, yeah, there does come a point where you want to get your work out there. And yeah.
It's impossible to be a writer without having some sort of portfolio of failure behind you.
It's how you learn, isn't it? And you hopefully get some generous editors who'll give you a bit of feedback and when you start to get published.
Well, one of our good friends from Cronscast, Tade Thompson, he sent out a tweet not long ago and he said, one of the best pieces of advice I can give writers is to give yourself permission to write crap.
Oh, absolutely. I think that's kind of how we are able to write in the first place, isn't it? Yeah. If you sit down and think I'm going to be the new Shakespeare and this is going to be perfect, then yeah, no, don't put that kind of pressure on yourself.
I think there's a lot of management of expectations and hopes have to be brought into the equation. And also the fact that many roads can lead to the same destination. How many, Dan, authors have we spoken to who took the same route to get published, whether it's short stories, anthology, or novels? They're all different. You know, sometimes it's luck, sometimes it's graft, sometimes it's networking. There's so many different ways to do it. We now live in a society with TV shows that promise instant talent, like Britain's Got Talent or X Factor.
Social media makes everybody a celebrity. I know what you're getting at, but that's part of it as well.
Well, I'm saying specifically to the cachet of a proper celebrity, because I think at the moment social media is still like content creator is still like a bit of a dirty word, or TikTok. she or he does TikTok videos. It's a little bit sort of there's a bit of snobby around that. They might be earning money, but whatever. But the thing is, if you're not into music or dance or magic and you don't have a cat that can talk, then, you know, you can't go on Britain's Got Talent, but you might like to write. You might like, whether it's fan fiction or you might be serious about writing, but everybody else who's in this aspirational business is able to go somewhere like Britain's Got Talent, a local talent show, whatever it is, some quick feedback on their skills. Whereas in writing, it is a long journey. The learning is long. And the producing of one novel is long. And you don't get that. And I think that's why a lot of people fail or a lot of people get frustrated, is because they just don't have the ethic, the work ethos.
Even if they do, it takes such a long time to get the feedback that, you know, the head can go down,
yeah,
can't it?
Exactly.
Yeah. And it's the love for the words part of it that gets you through those times, isn't it?
It really is.
Onto the next thing and the next thing.
Do you have anybody that So, for example, Dan and I work very closely together with our writing when it comes to having each other read, having other people read our stuff. I will go to Dan because he likes my stuff, or
and that's fine, you know. And I think it's useful to have a cheerleader, isn't it?
Yeah, but it's what I meant was, you know what I'm going for, and I think I know what you're going for, and I think that's made it quite easy for us to talk like this, because I've just thought about what I've said. And Alison might have a writer's group around her that help buoy her up in the way that we do on Crons, our contacts within Crons, the way I have you and Pete and, you know, the others. I just realized, yeah, maybe it is something people need support with, because they might not have the support that we do. I was wondering, Alison, are you in splendid isolation?
I am and I'm not, really. I don't kind of have beta readers or anything like that. I tend to do a lot of editing myself, and I tried to clear my head sort of between drafts by working on a short story or just turning my hand to something else for a while, so that I almost try and forget what I've been working on and then come to it as freshly as I can after a break. But then obviously it goes off to an actual editor and the editing starts again, you know what I mean? And I've learned an awful lot through working with Joe Fletcher Books and editors at Titan, who, you know, I've been lucky to work with some really great people and they've taught me a lot. Yeah, but I mean, the actual early drafts until I hand something in, it's splendid isolation.
But what about before you made those contacts? Who were you? Did you have anyone to share with? Did you have anybody to sort of bounce ideas off with before you had any interest, before you got any professional publishing qualifications?
I started off, actually, really started off creative writing at all by going to a local class. So I did start off in that way at the very beginning. And then when I started writing short stories and submitting those to magazines, I was working with editors in the indie presses who would edit my work as well. So yeah, get feedback then. But also I do have a good network now of writer friends that I see at FantasyCon, and there was ChillerCon earlier this year and other events like that, like Edgelit at Derby.
Yeah.
And, you know, just having that network where... As a writer, I think you get quite used to meeting a lot of people who aren't really into what you're into, or and they don't really understand the writing process. And it's just great to suddenly walk into a convention like that and suddenly everybody understands. And, you know, I can go from being quite an introverted, quiet person to somebody who's like talking 90 miles an hour with loads of different people. And it's just like finding your tribe, isn't it?
Yeah.
So yeah, I certainly have a support network, and I keep in touch with them on social media as well. So it's not quite as isolated as all that. They're around, and I get to see what they're doing, what they're working on, and we email each other sometimes, and the connections are there.
Is there anything else that you wanted to talk about, Ali, while you're on the podcast before we wrap up?
No, I don't think so.
Okay, well, thanks for joining us on this Christmas ghost story special.
Thank you very much.
That's okay. And can we ask how you're planning on spending Christmas? Are you going to be hauling large tendrils of mistletoe all across your mantelpiece and in between the cracks in the floorboard?
Yeah, we usually go out and somehow end up with a Christmas tree that's about 2 feet too high for the room that we put it in. And there was one memorable year when the trunk was too big to cut through, so we just kind of chopped the top off it.
What do you do the thing where you chop the top off of the tree and then take the top bit and put it on the floor above?
I did that. I actually hung things on it. Yeah. So it was like little and large.
Very good. Right. Well, thanks very much, Ali. It's been a delight.
Yes, thank you, Ali. I really appreciated hearing about your process as well for mistletoe.
I've enjoyed it. Thanks for inviting me.
You're very welcome. Have a great Christmas.
You too.
Oh yeah, happy Christmas, everyone.
Happy Christmas.
episode of Kronzcast was brought to you by Dan Jones and Christopher Bean with our special guest, Alison Littlewood. Additional content was provided by Damaris Brown, Brian Sexton and Jay Styliper. Special thanks to Brian Turner and all the staff at Kronz, and thanks to you for listening. If you want to join, for free, the world's largest science fiction and fantasy community, visit sffchronicles.com. And last but not least, have a very Merry Christmas and a Happy New Year. And thanks for joining us throughout 2022. We hope to have you with us throughout 2023. Next month, we will be joined by Chad Pfeiffer and Chris Lackey, the hosts of the seminal podcasts HP Podcraft and Strange Studies of Strange Stories. Chad and Chris will be talking about the cult of 19...